You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Community Connections. Being the second Wednesday of the month, it's the Legal Hour, and we have our friends from Hutchison Legal, Madeleine and Annabelle. Welcome, ladies.
Good afternoon, Alan. It's afternoon already.
It is afternoon, and we're nearly halfway, or over halfway through the year. It's everything's happening, isn't it?
Skating along.
Now, last time when someone was in, last month, we sent them away with a question, as we got about two today, to send you away with. But what did we send you away with, and what was the answer, please?
Well, Annabelle's going to talk about this section.
Yeah, that's fine. So I think the first question that we had was, can all fines be challenged?
Yes.
And I guess the answer is that all fines can be, you know, requested for a review. Definitely, everyone has a right to ask for a review or a reason why the fines were provided to them and why the fines were given to them.
How do they go about challenging a fine?
Yeah, definitely. So there are two ways to do it. We're talking about speeding fines on there's Vic Roads, or just general fines. We can always go to Fines Victoria's website to have an internal review on. It's also interesting that you could get a review of your fines with the Victoria Police. If you are going on a speeding ticket, it's under 10 km, the Victoria Police can also issue you an official warning instead of a fine, so no payments required.
So do you have to ask them for, like, obviously you've got to ask them for an appeal, but do you then ask them for a warning, or is that at their discretion?
Yes. So if it's under 10 km, you can write to them and request for it to be a warning, official warning instead of it being a fine payable to Fines Victoria.
Very good. So, it can only be, though, if it's under 10 kilometres an hour.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's also the discretion of the Victorian Police, but generally it's under 10 kilometres.
Right. So if it was over 10, do you then appeal to the courts, or it's just a dead loss, you can't appeal?
So you do apply to Fines Victoria to get it reviewed, and then, you know, if you're going to challenge it even further, it does go to the Magistrates Court the ultimatum of where this goes, yes.
Beauty. All right, look, we better play that bit of music, because we promised people we're going to play it. I'll just play that and we'll be back.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now we're back on track. You're listening to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. And it's our legal hour, and we've got Madeleine and Annabelle with me. Now, also part of what we were talking about these fines and that, we asked about community corrections. So what happens with that, Lois?
Yeah, so community corrections order can actually be made only in this magistrate's, county or Supreme Court. These orders are usually more serious than a fine, but I guess not as severe as a jail term. The orders may be imposed for up to 2 years if made in the magistrate's court. And what happens is that if you are given a community corrections order, you actually have a corrections case manager to report to, and I guess an appointment date and time will be made, so you have to report your do's and don'ts to them. It's interesting that the terms have to be followed. For example, you have to let corrections know if you even change your address. You have to stay in Victoria the entire time unless you get a permission to leave. You have to comply with any directions that the corrections give you, so on and so forth. So it's an order that's given by the court for you to ensure that you follow it correctly and that you'll have a case manager to go alongside with you.
But the question is, mm-hmm. does the magistrate's court ever follow up to see that those people have been doing that?
Yeah, essentially, one would think that the case manager would be the one who follows up with you, and if you don't follow up with them, or if they don't follow up with you, then the magistrate's court will,
There's departments in the Department of Justice which are assigned to make sure people comply with corrections orders.
So but the actual magistrate's court doesn't charge
No, it's moved over to the administrative wheel and they would only go back to the magistrate's court if they wanted a variation or of an order if someone wasn't complying. Right. But Annabelle was saying how there's always the possibility if you do review a fine that a magistrate might impose a greater fine. So you need to think carefully about your circumstances before you go challenging things.
Fair enough. So
Now,
let's change the subject because that's answered what happened last time. Superannuation. I believe there's been some changes come up on superannuation, please.
That's right, Alan. And I was going to direct listeners to our website, which we had a revamp of our website in March and it's all looking very glitzy and interesting and glamorous and lots of photos. But there's access to all our newsletters and we produce those quarterly. And the last one had an article on the changes to superannuation laws which came in on the 1st of July 2021. And it's a very technical area, but basically concessional contributions, which are the ones made before tax from a person's salary. Well, there's the compulsory one that's gone up to 10%. That's right.
Yep.
And then an employee can also make concessional contributions, which is before tax.
Is there a limit on
and that? And that has gone up to $27,500 per annum.
There is a dollar value.
Yeah, from 25. Yep. They've just put it up a bit. And then non-concessional contributions, which are after tax, which you want to make outside your employer, has gone up from $100,000 to $110,000 or $330,000 per 3 years. You can make it all in one lump sum.
As long as it does. Yep.
And for the over 65s, the work test has relaxed a bit. This is for people aged between 67 and 74. And to satisfy the work test, you must work at least 40 hours during a consecutive 30-day period each income year.
So it's only 40 hours a month, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And there's an exemption which applies from 1 July 2019 for contributions made up to a year after you've satisfied the work test. So it's a little bit more relaxed than it was.
Yep.
But in order to qualify for that exemption, you have to have less than $300,000 in super. But the thing that I wanted to stress, which a lot of people don't know about, is the downsizer contribution, which allows people over 65 who sell their house to put a lump sum of $300,000 into super. And if it's in the year just following you finishing work, you could actually effectively put $600,000 in. The 300 I was just talking about, plus your 300 downsizer contribution.
Yeah, that's all right, isn't it?
So it's huge, and a lot of people don't know that if they sell their house, they can do that.
And that's encouraging people to sell a big house, isn't it?
Exactly. That's right. And to set themselves up for the future.
Yeah.
With super, the balance is inflated to a reasonable size. And then after you turn 60, you're able to access your super provided you're no longer working. But if you are working, that age limit is 65. And after 65, you can take out lump sums.
Doesn't matter whether you're working or not.
No, that's right. That's right. So that's a good threshold to get to.
Yeah.
It's much more flexible. You can use it as a bank then, although you've got to be careful. That's right. You can't necessarily put it back again. So you have to be careful.
And
you
don't want to take too much out because you could run out of super before you pass on.
Absolutely. And that's the big query is just how long you're going to need it for. Yes.
None of us know.
No, that's right. These days it's getting longer and longer. And just a final note, the government did make super accessible during COVID as a sort of financial hardship means, but that unfortunately finished in January of this year, so that's no longer available.
That's probably a good idea, though, isn't it? Because you don't want people buying cars and all that sort of stuff.
No, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And I mean, the whole situation has eased. It's not over, but it has eased. I mean, we are back to work, essentially. So hopefully it's not as needed as it was when we were in complete lockdown. And people, particularly the entertainment or the restaurant industry and so forth, they were just so
completely short, weren't they?
Yeah, it was really hard for them. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. And I should say, if anybody's got any just general legal questions they want answered, give us a ring pretty quickly on 59-615-991. 59-615-991. Only too happy to get you some answers, but you need to be pretty quick because the hour goes very quickly. Annabelle, with COVID-19, it's on the tips of our tongues, and I know that people are concerned, and probably not enough people are getting vaccinated yet. I don't want the anti-vaxxers ringing me up because whatever we've got to do, we've got to do to get out of this. But the major thing is, at some stage, will an employer be able to say, well, if you haven't had the COVID-19, I'm not going to employ you, or you can't come to work?
Yes, well, there are different rules in terms of whether an employer can allow a prospective employee to be vaccinated, require a prospective employee to be vaccinated, or a current employee to be vaccinated. So essentially, if you are a prospective employee, your employer can request that you be vaccinated, I guess, depending on which area that you're working in, which industry as well. One good example would be the aged care workers. It's the National Cabinet has agreed to mandate that at least the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine be administered by mid-September 2020
Does that mean that, first of all, they can discriminate or just not employ that person? And B, what if the person is already employed in that situation?
There's a big difference. If they're employed, start with that.
So if they're employed, the employers cannot force them to do it unless, obviously, in the sectors that the National Cabinet has requested. And, you know, while they can encourage, for example, giving incentives or giving sick leave, giving extra cash, for example, there's no rules to say that the employer has to or can require all employees to be vaccinated. But if it's a prospective employee, then it's really on a case-by-case basis. You know, the employer will see why the employee is not getting vaccinated, whether it's religious purposes, pregnancy, for example, medical reasons, or is it just a case of an anti-vaxxer? So it's really, I guess, a case-by-case basis as to what the employer thinks as well. And obviously there are rules to anti-discrimination laws in place. So I guess the employer can't really discriminate you just because of it.
So would the COVID-19 override the anti-discrimination or not? Anti-discrimination would still come in?
Yes, I think
it does come in.
Anti-discrimination will still come in for this instance, yes.
So I just wanted to make it clear that the government employers can require aged care workers to get vaccinated. Yep. That's a different kettle of fish.
What about, say, childcare?
I think it's only aged care.
Yeah,
at
this current stage is just residential aged care.
Mm.
Well, I guess the other argument, let me just be the devil advocate, and I don't like doing this to you, but if all the aged care are vaccinated, the people in the care, does the worker still could be discriminated against?
When I said the anti-discrimination laws apply, we were talking about prospective employers.
I get that.
But the aged care workers is a whole separate kettle of fish, as I said, because the Cabinet has provided that it is mandatory for them all to be vaccinated by September 2021, at least the first dose.
And that's fair enough, isn't it?
And they've also left the door open for that to be the case with quarantine workers, but they haven't quite mandated it yet.
Oh, haven't they?
No.
I would have thought that would have been met.
I would have too, but...
Interesting as well as different states have different public health orders. Some states, such as, you know, New South Wales, has what we call the airport and quarantine vaccination program, so everyone working in transport are required to be vaccinated. And in Victoria, we don't have that yet. We're not sure if it will kick in or not. But it's just a good food for thought in the industry that you work in, whether it will be mandatory or whether it would just be something that highly encouraged, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back with more.
Still a bag again. Rising sun just stole my girl away. Now we're a party, think I better ever regain. But with the scuba of little fever, yeah, I'm getting more cards, we're getting no man with girl. I'm the tail of the boat. If you don't come home, I know just where I'm gonna go. The rising sun just stole my girl away. Is it the rising sun?
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's only 23 minutes to one. Time's getting on, 11 degrees. So if you've got an answer or a question you'd like answered about the law, but it's got to be just generally about the law. We can't talk about a case, but give us a ring pretty quickly on 59-615-991. 59-615-991. Madeline, I've lost my train of thought, eh?
That's all right.
Right now. You want to talk about property disclosure, and this is where somebody has been murdered or something in the property, isn't it?
That's right. So, Ellen, I'm not a property lawyer, and neither is Annabelle, and I think our property lawyer is due to come and talk to you in a couple of months. But I was intrigued as to where this requirement that you disclose whether someone's been murdered or committed suicide in your property, where that's come from, and I knew it was fairly recent. So I've looked into the background, and prior to the 1980s, it was a case of caveat emptor, which is buyer beware, and you really bought what you saw, and that was it. But in the 80s, the Sale of Land Act required, and Victoria's one of the strictest states on this, required that a vendor disclose all the information. Well, yeah, certain information about a property. That was the case in the 80s. Yep. And what they couldn't do was fraudulently not disclose something, like really trick the purchaser.
Is it a case? I know that it covers sort of murder and that. What if a person who actually lives in the house just dies from natural causes? Is that still part of the disclosure?
Well, this is what I'm getting to. In 2020, actually, it became... In 2020, it became a requirement that you didn't have to fraudulently fail to disclose. If you knowingly failed to disclose a fact, that a material fact that was relevant to the purchaser, then it was a criminal offence which was punishable by up to 12 months imprisonment. And the question is, well, what is a material fact relevant to the purchaser that would induce them to buy the property? And it turns out there are quite a lot of material facts, and there are things such as prior tests or investigation that have revealed a defect in the structure of the building, a termite infestation, combustible cladding, asbestos, those sorts of things, or an underlying cause of an obvious physical defect. So there might be a crack in the wall which people can see, but if you know why the crack's there, then you're obliged to disclose it. Or if there's been a significant event at the property, including a flood or bushfire, or a history of pesticide in the event the property has been used for horticulture, or the one which is described by... the property during the current or previous occupation has been the scene of a serious crime or an event which may create long-term potential risks to the health and safety of the occupiers. So that's drug manufacturing.
Yep.
And a serious crime. So if someone's died, I don't think that...
It's not a crime, is it?
No, but but if you know that that person, if they've specifically asked, then it would be an offence not to tell them.
Oh, yep.
And so it's got to be particular to the purchasers. So you might wonder if you have to disclose something like the fact that the neighbours do wheelies up and down the street, you know, at 12 o'clock every night or whatever, and you know that this person's a shift worker and they've specifically said, is it a quiet street? You would be obliged to disclose that fact.
Oh, right.
If you know it.
It's fairly wide head, isn't it?
Definitely.
That's right. So it's something that's induced, and so particularly if the purchaser asks these questions and it's induced them to buy the property, you are obliged to tell them. So you can't knowingly withhold that information. Yeah.
Oh, very good.
So, and it does give people the grounds to rescind the contract if they later find out this is the case. So you could be liable for quite a bit of damages.
Yeah.
For not disclosing.
Don't want to do that. All right, look, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Yarra Valley FM acknowledges the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land we broadcast from. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks
and
for listening.
Hello to you, Grant. I hope you're listening in, and if not, they're doing a great job for you, but at the end of the week, there'll be a podcast up, so you could always have a listen and see what a great job they did. Just go to our Facebook, not our Facebook, go to our
webpage
and look down there for My Smiling Face and click on that, and there'll be a whole lot of podcasts there. So you'll be able to listen to it, Grant, but I'm sure you'll be happy. Anyway, look, we always give you a case or some questions that we've had asked for us. Now, this one, we've actually had two different calls, and they both, I think, might taper in together. The first one is somebody wants to know what the powers are of security guards, what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. You know, as they obviously can't arrest people because they don't have the powers of arrest. What are they allowed to do? But also, does the powers alter between whether they're inside a property, because if they're in the property, it's obviously private, or it's owned, even though it's might be a shop or something. But does that alter when they go out onto the footpath, because they're now on Crown land or whatever you like? So that's the first one. What are the powers of security guards and do they alter? But also, somebody rang up about store detectives. Now, I don't know whether there's the same as security guards or what, but again, they would like to know what powers a store detective has. And again, when they're in the shop, the store detective is probably being employed by that shop, what powers they have in there, because it's obviously that they're in an owned property. If they walk outside and it's in like a plaza, we'll say Ringwood or Knox City or one of those, when they walk out of the shop, they're still on owned property because, you know, it's there's a walkway, passageway. So that could almost be declared as a shop. But when they go outside into the car park, do their powers alter? So there's quite a bit in that.
You've got very thinking listeners.
Well, that's what we're here. We're here to challenge you.
Inquisitive, yes.
And to ask, and we certainly had that question, both. It was just strange that they both came through, but one was talking about the security guards and the other person's talking about the store detective. And I guess you might be able to answer this. I mean, those, we want you to come back next week. Madeleine, when I'm thinking about this, store theft, where people go in and they pinch something, does the store detective, do they can't stop them in the shop, can they? Because all they say is, well, I haven't had a chance to pay yet, I'm going to pay other. Where does it become theft? The minute they walk past the cash register without paying? Or do you have to let them go outside and
I believe that's the case, but I've already said I'm not a property lawyer. I'm also not a criminal lawyer. But I know you're going to come to Will's. That's okay.
Yeah.
But I believe, obviously, there'd have to be evidence that they did not pay and didn't intend to pay.
So they'd have to go past the cash register.
I think so. And I also think the police have to do it. Unless it's a reason for a citizen's arrest, yeah. I don't think you can just go around, detaining people.
Well, as far as I've got a son who is a policeman, and they seem to be the only one that have the have the powers. Righto, now we'll get on to something that that is your forte,
yes.
And it would be a waste of me not asking you some questions. Wills, I heard of a case the other day where I think you and I might have discussed this a long while ago, where a mother had, I think, five children with a husband. When the children were young, the father took off and the mother stayed with the five children. Fairly soon after, as the kids got a bit older, they all went with Dad, except one daughter. And one daughter stayed behind until she was married, and then after she was married, she went and did her shopping with her mother, and as the mother got older, she took to all medical stuff and all that. So the mother wrote in the will, because she didn't just leave a letter, she put in the will that none of the other children were to get anything, and this is the reasons why. Now, the old lady died only a few months ago, and most of them said, oh, well, that's fair enough, you know, we didn't have anything to do with mum, why should we? But a person, or one of the daughters who had plenty of money, decided to challenge the will. But she dragged in her brother, who didn't have any money. So the whole thing went along and at the will reading and all that. And the solicitor said, look, I think you're going to have to try and do some sort of settlement here, because it's going to cost you the fortune, as you're going to tell me in a minute. But so in the end, they had to go to arbitration, and the person who'd arbitrated said, well, I'm going to give the boy $50,000. Oh, first of all, they wanted thirds and all that, but it came down to $50,000. Now, the arbitrator said that $50,000 is to go to the boy, or to the man, not you, because you got plenty of money. What could happen if that daughter says, well, I fought this whole case, now I want $40,000 of that? So how would you go in a case like that?
Okay, there's a lot of factors at play.
Yep.
First of all, there's only a few people who can apply for greater provision under a will, and an adult child is one of them. So that they meet that requirement.
Yep.
But there's a lot of factors taken into account. If it was to go to court, the court would look at the nature of the relationship.
Which wasn't there.
No, that's right. And those factors are vital to...
Right.
They're taken into account. Also, what's in the will. The court must look at what's in the will. In the old legislation before 2015, it was just may, but now they must take account of what the testator actually wanted.
Right.
And the nature of the relationship and the contribution that was made to her survival and her assets and all that sort of thing.
Yep.
Whole list of factors are taken into account. But the one overriding thing that the court must look at now is the ability of the beneficiary to make provision for themselves. So that daughter would have had an uphill battle if it had gone to court, if she was well established herself.
She was, yep.
Yeah. So in a lot of situations, a lot of siblings are very aggrieved by the fact that it's the wayward child that can obtain further provision, not the ones who have worked hard all their lives and they're all set up. So the court looks at the needs of the individual, and that's related to the obligation of the will maker to make provision for that child if they haven't been able to make provision for themselves.
Even though in this case that child who was doing very badly, the boy we're talking about, he'd still had nothing to do with his mum for 35 years.
Well, the thing is, it didn't go to court, so they're really just going on the principles of what a court would decide.
And it's cheaper to do a settlement now than go to court.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. So it was a bit of a try-on by the daughter who had money.
Yep.
It was a big try-on, really.
Yep.
And the mediator obviously saw what a court might do, and that is make an award for the one who wasn't as well established.
Right. So having then made that order, supposing, would the daughter be breaking any law if she said, well, I'm going to take 30 out of your 50 and you can just go blow it off?
Well, I assume terms of settlement would have been signed at that mediation, so it's too late for anything after the terms of settlement.
Once I give him the 50 grand, the point I'm trying to make, what's to stop her taking some money off him? Nothing.
Well,
has she broken the law if she did?
Well, she can't breach the terms of settlement.
Can't she?
So she would have agreed not to make any further claim against the estate. So that she can't go against what she's agreed. She can't start another action if she's agreed to stop there.
Yep.
So the answer is she can't.
She can't.
No.
Right. So while I've got you, because I know you're a specialist in the wills, and we're fast running out of time, so what are the biggest mistakes that people make in their writing a will or not having a will? So what are the biggest mistakes that you've come across?
Actually, we were talking about this on the drive up.
You must have known I was going to ask a question.
Yeah, absolutely. So people don't seem to know how their property is registered. So it's okay if they're husband and wife, it's usually joint tenants. But in blended families and second relationships, it's often as tenants in common, which means they own half each.
Yep.
And people just don't seem to know that. And that makes a huge difference, because if it's joint tenants, it's not even in the estate. It goes to the survivor. It's not dealt with by the will.
Oh, right.
So, and if it's tenants in common and they own half each and they agreed to leave it to their respective children, they have to leave a right to reside to the other partner, or else the children can throw them out.
Throw them out.
So I see a lot of gaps in wills that are made without a right to reside to the other partner until she either dies or sells, or you can make provision that she be able to use the money for her aged care.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the children. So that can be a big hole in the will if that provision's not made.
Is there any, you were talked about the blended family, is there any, well, not discrimination, but is there any sort of, like, is there a difference between the children, put it this way, or they, once they blend, they've always got the same equal right?
No, there can be a difference depending on, I mean, that's the starting point, is that they're all equal, but depending on their input into the relationship with their parents and their needs and that sort of thing, it can vary a little bit. And the will maker can put in their will why they're leaving unequal distributions.
So obviously you would suggest that nobody tries to write their own will.
I would suggest that. Yes, I would. We had a great case in the office just quickly where someone had three children by three different partners, and he wanted to leave it to his daughter, his youngest daughter, and he wrote out his will and he said, "And I leave my whole residuary estate to," and forgot to put her name in. And it created an intestacy And he hadn't actually divorced his first wife, so she popped up and said, well, it's mine. And according to intestacy, it was.
It was?
Well, yes, but there was a battle and a settlement, but it was a messy case.
And the trouble is, and you know this better than I suppose, that if you start into the courts, it now starts to cost a lot of money,
doesn't absolutely.
It? And the estate has to pay that, doesn't it?
Unless there's a reason, unless someone was mischievous in starting an action, in which case the person themselves could have to pay. But basically, usually the estate pays.
Unfortunately, ladies, it's hit 1 o'clock and I've got to take the news. So thank you for coming along.
Thank you for having us, Alan.
No worries. Alan. It's always a pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.